That was a good song for this morning. That works out great. We're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 49. Jeremiah chapter 49, the title of my lesson this morning is, Where Do You Place Your Trust? And so that worked out great. I didn't tell him that either. So that worked out awesome. If you didn't get a handout this morning, raise your hand. We want to make sure you got one. If you didn't get a handout, our guys will make sure you get one. If you didn't get one when you came in, I think we have everybody. Brother Paul down here, thank you, sir. I think that's everybody, though. Appreciate it. We're going to be in Jeremiah 49. We're getting to the end of the book. There are only 52 chapters in this book. And this one, we're going to, this whole section of Jeremiah, what he's been doing, he preached most of his book, chapters 2 through 45, to Judah and to Israel. And so most of it's centered on God's people. But the very last section, chapter 46 through 51, is going to be to the foreign nations, which reminds us that God's not just concerned with his people, he's also paying attention to everything that's going on around the world. And we're going to see a lot of the themes that are going to come into all of these being repeated. But most of these messages he gives are all doom and gloom, all of them. This is at the same time that Judah is about to go into captivity. Babylon is taking over the world, which means they don't only take over Judah, they take over everybody else too. And so this message, he spiritualizes what's happening in their lives with these individual messages he's given. A lot of these prophecies he gives to these different nations have a lot of similarities. Often there's an indictment against their character. Sometimes there's not, and he just tells them that destruction is going to come, and we already know that they're a wicked nation. A description of how they're going to fall, often in kind of vague terms, shows up in these messages, that soldiers are going to come and the people will flee the city and there won't be enough food. And so general descriptions of their fall. And then it's often laid out how they felt, how they responded, what they did because of everything that was going on and what was going on in their head and in their heart. We see in each of these, it also says how specifically what they trusted in had been dismantled. And that's what we're going to see here this morning in chapter 49. Many recurring themes in this chapter also correspond with some of the messages we preached the last few weeks about Philistia and Egypt and Moab. But the last point last week when we were looking at the country of Moab in chapter 48, the very last point that I made was that the wrong answer and how we respond to the world's problems is that we place our trust in anything other than God. Because we will all place our trust in something. We do trust things. We rely on things. But we should be placing our trust in the Lord rather than something that's going to disappoint us and to fail us. We've all exercised trust this morning. Nobody I saw checked whether or not the pew was stable when they sat down in it. Nobody looks worried that they're going to hit the floor. You trust that the pew looks fairly sturdy. I mean, they're not new. They've been around for many years, and nobody walked in and said, I don't know about this. We place our trust in it. Most people this morning got in a giant bucket of metal that's filled with extremely flammable fluid and went down the road at a very high speed, fully expecting to arrive safely this morning. We place our trust in many things along the way every day. Now, the thing is, we often see what we truly trust in life when things go wrong. Because then we realize what we fall back on and what we know to be secure. Many years ago now, I think it might be like 5 years ago now, I preached a message on Psalm 91. And when I preached the message on Psalm 91, I talked about roadkill. We talked about roadkill just the other day. Miss Sam, that talked to the teenagers. My wife, Sam, she comes from California, and the Southern California is a desert. There's not living things there. And so there's not a lot of animals just roaming the street, which means there's not a lot of roadkill. So she gets married to me, and she comes into Pennsylvania, and she's appalled by all the miles of carnage that are down the street when you just try to drive through the countryside. And And I told her, I promise you, one of these days, I'm sorry, but you're gonna hit an animal. It's gonna happen, and you're just gonna have to be okay with it. Well, one day, I'm at work, and I get a call on the phone. Nathan! What? What's up? What's wrong? What's happening? What do you need me to do? I hit a squirrel today. He just came out. I had no time to respond, and I see his tail waving in the wind in the rearview mirror, like a white flag saying, I surrender. And she's like, why are you laughing at me? It's not funny. I promise you, it's not funny. But I've often, there's a lot of things I'm not surprised that they die when they get the road. Like possums, they don't run fast. What do they expect? They need 5 minutes of clearance. Of course they didn't make it across. But squirrels always surprise me because they're very quick. Why do so many of them get hit? You would think that they'd be smarter. They have plenty of time. And most of the time you watch them and the actions don't make a lot of sense. Have you ever been driving down the road and a squirrel crosses the road and you're coming up to it and you're thinking to yourself, if they're just smart, this will all go well. And they hop across and then they stop in the middle. And they're almost to the other side. They're almost there, but then they get scared by your car. And so they turn around and they try to go back. I was saying that to somebody one time, and they were somebody who does more stuff in nature and whatever. And they said, well, actually, there's a reason for that. Why? Tell me why do squirrels do such foolish things? And they said, well, because when a squirrel gets scared enough, often their first reaction is to run home. And 50% of the time, home is on the other side of the road. And so it doesn't matter that it makes sense to you as you're watching their movements. To them, they say, I need to go where it's safe. And they run back. Because when we're scared or something is wrong, we will run to what we trust. And we all do the same thing. When something is wrong and we don't know what's going on, we will run to what we trust. When I preached that message on Psalm 91, I gave you the first two verses. The psalmist is saying that that's where his trust is. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in Him will I trust. Now, we were thinking about this because as I looked at this chapter, and this chapter is a little bit different, because in this one chapter, we see his message to five different groups of people. Now, I could have made this five different weeks, but rather than belaboring some of these points that are going to come up, I looked in each of them, and this is true for Moab and Philistia and Egypt as well, but you can see in each of them that there was something that they thought was going to help them and did not. And he's pointing it out. That they thought that where their trust was going to be ended up failing them. So I'm going to give you four different places that we can trust in our life, that if we trust in them, we will fail us. So where do you put your trust? And so we're going to look at each one individually. The first point is going to be a little quicker, but I wanted us to see this before we went to the second point, which is a little bit longer. Number one, what do we trust? Do we trust our entitlement? Our entitlement. Now, this is interesting. I want you to look at verse number 1, and we're just going to read down to verse number 3 for this one. Now, there's another point that we'll see in this first nation that I'll put to point number 2. But look at verse number 1. Concerning the Ammonites, thus saith the Lord, hath Israel no sons? Hath he no heir? Why then doth their king inherit Gad, and his people dwell in his cities? Therefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, I'll cause an alarm of war to be heard in Reba of the Ammonites. It shall be a desolate heap, her daughters shall be burned with fire. Then shall Israel be heir unto them that were his heirs, saith the Lord. Howl, O Heshbon, for Ai is spoiled. Cry, ye daughters of Reba, gird you up with sackcloth, lament, and run to and fro by the hedges, for their king shall go into captivity. And his priests and his princes together. Let's stop there for now. But we see their judgment described. Their cities, especially one of their primary cities, Reba, will burn with fire. The people will be destroyed. The people will mourn. Their own king will go into captivity. Now, some people believe that underneath that, that statement, their king, it's actually pointing to the one that they that leads them, which is their God. Regardless, that wouldn't be foreign terminology for them. Regardless, he's saying that everything is going to fall apart. But he starts this whole thing with a strange statement. Did you notice that in verse number one? Hath Israel no heir, because you live in their cities. Now, an heir is what you would pass on, what belongs to you. He says, does Israel have no heir? Because Ammon, you are living in their property. So if you look at a map, Ammon is just on the other side of the Jordan River, like just over the other side. Moab's a little bit south on the other side of the Dead Sea. Ammon is north of them. North of Ammon is where 2.5 of the tribes of Israel lived, Reuben, Gad, the half-tribe of Manasseh. And Ammon, throughout its history, was often picking at those tribes because they were next door. During the time of Jephthah, for example, in the book of Judges, chapter 11, that's when they went and got him because Ammon was picking at them. During the reign of Saul, the people over in Gilead, which is that whole area, asked for help because Ammon was threatening them. They show up all throughout the times of the kings. And what they would continue to do is try to steal Israel's property like it belonged to them. And they say, is it that the Israelites have no kids to pass on their property to, that you think that it just belongs to you then? And then he goes on to say at the end that Israel's going to have it back. Ammon, you thought that you were Israel's heir. Israel will be your heir after you, and they will take all that property back. And we see this natural tendency to assume that what's around them belongs to them, and that will be their safety, that it should be mine. I deserve it. Now, this is how children act. One of the first things they learn to say is mine. More. To whine when they don't get their way. But we live in a world today that adults are taught to react to the world the same way. Mine. More. They whine if it does not go their way, and they assume, they are taught, that everything around them they deserve to have. And there is a sense in which we can trust that for our own safety. When things are falling apart, we can fall back on the idea that it's okay because I deserve to be taken care of by somebody else. I deserve to have your things. I don't have enough money, but it's okay because I deserve yours. My entitlement. That it belongs to me. But the thing is, sometimes we can have that, and we can get frustrated seeing that, watching the news, or seeing another political leaning. But the thing is, living in America, we can tend to have that mindset. I'll be okay because I have rights. I deserve certain things, and so I'll be fine because I am owed X, Y, and Z. And since I'm owed these things, then I will certainly have these things, and that will make me safe. Our entitlement. I'm going to leave that one alone because I think that gives the point well enough. But I really want to go to point number two. What do we trust? Do we trust our entitlement like Ammon did? Do we trust our, number two, safety nets? Our safety nets. So we're going to read the rest of Ammon, and then we're going to move on to Edom. This is the longest passage of scripture that we'll read. Verse number four. Wherefore, gloriest thou in the valleys, thy flowing valley, O backsliding daughter, that trusted in her treasures, saying, who shall come unto me? Behold, I'll bring a fear upon thee, saith the Lord God of hosts, from all those that be about thee, and ye shall be driven out every man right forth, and none shall gather up him that wandereth. And afterward I will bring again the captivity of the children of Ammon, saith the Lord. Now, he emphasizes that they're in a valley. Why is that significant? Why does it matter, the terrain on which their property is? Well, at that time in history, your terrain really did matter, whether or not you were safe or whether or not you were more secure. A valley is only considered to be a valley if it's surrounded by mountains. And if you lived in a valley, there was a sense that you had a natural wall around you. And so you trusted in the valley You trusted in the mountain range that surrounded you, which provided with you safety. It's okay because we can fall back in this safe place that we are. And they also talked about this. They trusted in their treasures. A backsliding daughter, that trust is in her treasures. It's okay. What happens, whatever comes, I'll be able to handle it because I have enough money. And that's how they often handled issues back then. If I wasn't safe enough, it's okay. I could pay off somebody. If we have enough treasures, we have enough money to handle what comes our way. And he says, but Ammon, you don't. It doesn't matter you have a mountain range, and it doesn't matter that you have treasures. This will not go well for you. So that's what he says to Ammon. Let's look at Edom. Verse number 7. I don't usually mix the two together, and Edom is the longest one as well. Verse number 7. Concerning Edom, thus saith the Lord of hosts, is wisdom no more in Teman, which was one of their cities? Is counsel perished from the prudent? Is their wisdom vanished? So these people thought that they were wise. They had good counsel. And God's telling them that they're not as wise as they thought that they were. So why did they think that they were wise? Look on. Verse number 8. Flee ye, turn back, dwell deep, O inhabitants of Dedan, for I will bring the calamity of Esau upon him the time that I will visit him. Esau is Edom. He tells them to fall back and to dwell deep. What does he mean by dwelling deep? Where are they expecting to dwell deep? We're going to look at that in a moment. Look at verse number 9. He describes the fall of Edom. If grape gatherers come to thee, would they not leave some gleaning grapes? If thieves by night, they will destroy till they have enough. But I have made Esau bare. I have uncovered his secret places, and he shall not be able to hide himself. His seed is spoiled, and his brethren and his neighbors, and he is not. Pause. This is more poetic than we might be expecting. He simply says something that we would all take for granted. If you had a vineyard and you had grape gatherers and they went out to gather grapes, they wouldn't gather every single grape, right? There would be some to glean left over. Like, you wouldn't harvest everything. You would get a lot and you'd leave something behind. Likewise, if a thief came and a thief came to steal, he wouldn't steal literally everything. He would steal what he wanted till he had enough. He says, but unlike the grape gatherers and the thief, these nations are going to come to Esau and lay it bare. Edom will have nothing left. And they won't just be like the grape gatherers and like the thieves that take what they want and leave something behind. He says, Edom will have nothing. You see the contrast he's giving here? So he's describing their fall. They will take everything. Look at verse number 11. Leave thy fatherless children, I'll preserve them alive. Let thy widows trust in me. We're going to return to that in a little bit here. Verse 12, for thus saith the Lord, behold, they whose judgment was not to drink of the cup have assuredly drunken, and art thou he that shall altogether go unpunished? Thou shalt not go unpunished, but thou shalt surely drink of it. Now, we've already seen this in the book. God's judgment is often described as a cup that he offers to people. And when they drink of the cup, they drink of his judgment. This picture shows up all throughout the Bible. And earlier in the book of Jeremiah, people say, I won't drink of the judgment. But he says, but they will anyway. Likewise here, he says, they will drink of it. Verse number 13. I've sworn by myself, saith the Lord, that Bozra shall become a desolation, a reproach, a waste, and a curse. All the cities thereof shall be perpetual wastes. I have heard a rumor from the Lord, and an ambassador sent unto the heathen, saying, gather ye together and come against her and rise up to the battle, for lo, I will make thee small among the heathen and despised among men. So he's saying, he's seeing that the Lord is gathering people against this land. No matter how high they thought they were, they would be cut down. Look at verse 17. Edom shall be a desolation. And everyone that goeth by it shall be astonished and shall hiss at all the plagues thereof. As in the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah and the neighboring cities thereof, saith the Lord, no man shall abide there, neither shall a son of man dwell in it. He says, just like Sodom and Gomorrah, which was once high and then just fell apart, so will it be for Edom, and people will walk by and be astonished at what happened to it. Verse 19, behold, he shall come up like a lion from the swelling of Jordan against the habitation of the strong. I'll suddenly make him run away from her. And then the Lord looks out to find a man to do his bidding, to come to Edom, to overthrow them. Who is a chosen man that I may appoint over her? Who is like me, and who will appoint me the time, and who is that shepherd that will stand before me? Therefore, hear the counsel of the Lord that he hath taken against Edom, and his purposes that he hath purposed against the inhabitants of Teman. The beast of the flock shall draw them out. Surely he shall make his habitations desolate with them. Remember, the chapter begins by saying that Edom had wisdom, and Edom had counsel. They had it all together. But in verse 20, he says that God's counsel and his purposes were greater than theirs. Their wisdom and their counsel wasn't going to undo what God was doing. Verse 21, the earth is moved at the noise of their fall, at the cry of the noise thereof was heard in the Red Sea. He shall come up and fly as the eagle and spread his wings over Bozrah, and at that day shall the heart of the mighty men of Edom be as the heart of a woman in her pangs. They would be in labor and they would be falling apart. They wouldn't know how to handle the things that are coming their way, and their heart would fall, he's saying. Now let's go back to the verse that I skipped over on purpose. Our fellows are coming by the way. If you could put that attendance slip in, we'd appreciate it. So they thought they were wise. God's wisdom outsmarted them. They were destroyed. What did they trust in? So let's return to verse 16. Go back to verse 16. Because it appears that Edom thought that everything was going to be fine. They were smart. They knew what was going, they knew how to handle what was coming. But verse 16, thy terribleness hath deceived thee. Terribleness doesn't mean they were bad as much as their strength. They were great and powerful. And they deceived them. The pride of thine heart, O thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, that holdest the height of the hill, though thou shouldest make thy nest as high as the eagle, I will bring thee down from thence, saith the Lord. Edom, specifically, to this day, the area where they were is known for its caves and its fortresses that are carved into the side of mountains. So yeah, Edom thought, it's fine, no matter what happens, we could just hole ourselves up in the mountain and in the caves. We can hide ourselves in the clefts of the rock and we'll be fine. No matter what takes place, we can fall back on this fortress that we have made and we will undoubtedly be safe. But here's the problem. Edom doesn't last through this. And everything he says will be true. Well, they're saying, oh, there's threat of destruction. There's threat of us losing our power. There's threat of us becoming a desolation and an astonishment to the people around us. There's threat of that. It's okay because we can hole ourselves up in a rock and make a nest like an eagle does in a mountain. And God says, it's not going to be enough to hide you. Ammon trusted their valley. Ammon trusted their treasures. Edom trusted their fortress in the mountain. And it wasn't enough for any of them. Safety nets. Now, safety nets aren't bad to have. When we were out in California to visit Sam's parents, we went to the Santa Monica Pier. And there was all kinds of stuff and commotion and people and people selling things that were fried and all that kind of stuff. And then there was this area where there was this trapeze-like thing that people could do. I don't think they were practicing. I think it was something that they paid to be a part of. And so there's somebody who's actually like a trapezist. What are you if you do trapeze? I don't know. You have to tell me later. Somebody who does that is going back and forth on the swing, and you're able to climb up, and they hook you to the thing, and then you swing on the swing, and you're supposed to try to do a transfer. And so we sat there and watched a few people, and they were all scared to death to do it, and they were screaming while it was funny. But it was okay, because after they went off, they would let go, and they would fall into this large safety net that was sitting underneath of them. So of course they felt comfortable falling because there was a safety net underneath them that would undoubtedly catch them. The thing is, we all have, and we're taught to, and it's okay to have safety nets in life. That when things happen or when stuff goes wrong, we have something to fall back on. And there's wisdom in safety nets in our life. For example, savings, having money away in the bank for a rainy day or for when the rain destroys your house is good to have. And the Bible even commends that. I gave you one verse as an example. Proverbs 21 says there's treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise. The foolish man spendeth it up. So the foolish man takes what he could have as savings and he just gets rid of it all because he doesn't need it. And the wise man puts it away. So that's fine. It's fine to have insurance. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if there's going to be a fire. You don't know if you're going to get in a car crash. It's fine to have insurance. It's fine to have savings that are set apart. It's fine to have plans for retirement. But that's not the question. The question is not, do you have a safety net? The question is that what you trust? It wasn't bad for Ammon to live in a valley. No one's saying they were immoral to have a treasure trove. No one says that Edom was being foolish because they carved a fortress in the mountain. No one is saying that. But what God is saying is they trusted they would be okay because they lived in a valley. They trusted they would be fine because they had a treasure. They assumed everything was going to be okay because they had a fortress in the mountain. And the problem was, it wasn't enough for them. It's fine for us to have safety nets, but here's the thing. We cannot safety net ourselves for every situation that might come our way. And that's why we are filled with a world of people who are scared to death and worrying. Because they know no matter how many things they insure and no matter how many times they insure their insurance, they know that something is feasible that they won't be prepared for. They can have a huge savings, but they know there is a very realistic scenario where their savings wouldn't cover it. Safety nets are fine, and the Bible commends the wisdom of having it, but it does not commend the wisdom of trusting in it, because at the end of the day, it's trusting you and your capability of handling life's problems, and not that God's the one that takes care of you. Edom and Ammon trusted them, and it did not bode well for them. Do you trust your safety nets? I'm not saying you have them. I'm not saying go spend all your savings on a boat so that you're more spiritual so you can live by faith. That's not what I said, and you did not hear me say that. So don't tell your wife, Brother Nathan told me to buy a boat. But what I'm asking is, where do you run when things go wrong? What is it that you're relying on? What is it that you expect to catch you when things are unexpected? Safety net. Number three, maybe we trust that we deserve it. Maybe we trust that we've made a safety net to catch us. Maybe we trust, number three, our luck. Our luck. This one was interesting. Look at the next one. We're going to look at these kind of neighboring cities, Kedar and Hazor. Look at verse 28. Concerning Kedar and concerning the kingdoms of Hazor, now I skipped over Damascus, I'm going to return to them at the end. Concerning Kedar and concerning the kingdoms of Hazor, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, shall smite, thus saith the Lord, arise ye, go up to Kedar and spoil the men of the east. Their tents and their flocks shall they take away. They shall take to themselves their curtains, their vessels, their camels, and they shall cry unto them, fear is on every side. Flee, get you far off, dwell deep, O inhabitants of Hazor, saith the Lord, for Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, hath taken counsel against you and hath conceived a purpose against you. Arise, get you up unto the wealthy nation that dwelleth without care, saith the Lord, which have neither gates nor bars, which dwell alone. Their camels shall be a booty, the multitude of their cattle a spoil. I will scatter into all the winds them that are in the utmost corners, and I will bring their calamity from all sides thereof, saith the Lord. Hazor shall be a dwelling for dragons and a desolation forever. There shall no man abide there, nor any son of man dwell in it. Now, there's a little bit of difficulty in locating the exact geography of Hazor and Kedar. From the things it says here and from what most commentators would guess is at the very least they were Arabian tent-dwelling nomads. And we know, and so that's generally conceded. But as opposed to Ammon and Edom, who had their fortresses, their mountains, and their places to fall back on, These two, he says, they dwell without care, and they have no gates or bars. He says, because they dwell alone. So they're more nomadic, they live in tents, they're not the major city that's sitting on the hill, they're not a target. They're just a couple small groups of people who live in the middle of nowhere, and so they don't need the gates and the bars. Because I'm sure if Babylon's going to take over the world, they're going to leave us alone. Because we're just us, we're just the nomads with the tent. So we're okay. And they're not worried. They're not worried at all. They're not worried because they trust in God. They're worried because they assume that Babylon's not going to care about them. Have you ever watched a movie and it's like a spy movie or something, and they're underneath all the political, you know, what everybody else sees, the spy is dealing with some kind of nuclear threat or something like that, and part of you suddenly gets worried that we do live in a world where somebody could set up an atomic bomb, and then you remind yourself, I live in Dover, though. Nobody would bomb Dover. If I was going to bomb the United States, I would bomb New York or Los Angeles or Washington, D.C. But nobody anywhere in the world is saying, I'm going to hurt the United States. What about Dover? Yes, let's bomb them. And so we assume, hey, everything's going to be fine. Or we watch on TV and we see riots happening. We're thinking, oh, no, what's our country coming to? But it's okay. I live in Dover. And so that doesn't happen in Dover, so I'm probably okay because nothing's going to come my way. If I was the president of Russia, I wouldn't attack Dover. It wouldn't be worth my time. So I am kind of nervous about how unstable the world is, but it's okay because I live in the middle of nowhere. And Kedar and Hazor thought the same thing. We're not Ammon or Edom or Damascus or Nineveh. Egypt. We're not on anyone's radar. They don't care about us. We're just the people that live in the country. And here, it's right next to everybody else. Now, I'm not saying that we're necessarily going to fall and rise with what's happening in the rest of the world, but what I am saying is we cannot trust our isolation and our luck that bad things do not come our way. I can't tell you how many times I've thought that. Yeah, well, I live in Dover, so nothing bad's going to come here. So last year, we woke up in the morning one day, and we get on Facebook, and our neighborhood has a Facebook page, and our neighbor posts that her car was stolen. I live in a townhouse community, so my neighbor lives 5 feet from me, and her car was stolen, which means that meant the night before, when I was upstairs sleeping in my bed, and my wife and my child were upstairs soundly sleeping, there was somebody in my driveway checking if my door was unlocked. They later posted in the comment section, I moved here to get away from all of this. Because they fully expected if I go to the middle of nowhere like Dover, then those things won't come to me. And it was just a reminder that, hey, you cannot trust where you just may happen to be, assuming that nothing is going to come your way. And then suddenly, when we hear stories like that, we get really nervous because we're thinking, well, then where can I go and I'll be safe? The Lord. Because your isolation and your luck is not your trust. For Kedar and Hazor, it was. No one will know where I am. Nobody will care. That stuff doesn't happen here, so we're going to be fine. So we don't need to lock our doors. We don't need gates. We don't need bars. And I'm not saying don't lock your doors. I'm not saying do lock your doors. I'm saying don't trust that your deadbolt is going to be the safety for your family, because God is. You are your isolation is not your trust. And neither, lastly, number four, is your skill. Your skill. We might trust our entitlement. It's okay because I deserve to be taken care of. We might trust our safety nets. It's okay. I've gotten everything figured out. No matter what happens, I'm prepared. We might trust our luck. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's okay. It's probably not going to happen to me. Or we trust our skill. It's all right. I am capable of handling it. So let's look at the last group in this chapter. Verse number 34. The word of the Lord that came to Jeremiah the prophet against Elam in the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah, saying, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I'll break the bow of Elam, the chief of their might." And the rest of this looks familiar. "Upon Elam I will bring the four winds from the four quarters of heaven and will scatter them toward all those winds. There shall be no nation whither the outcasts of Elam shall not come. I'll cause Elam to be dismayed before their enemies and before them that seek their life. I'll bring evil upon them, even my fierce anger, saith the Lord. I will send the sword after them till I have consumed them. And I will set my throne in Elam and will destroy from thence the king and the princes, saith the Lord. But it shall come to pass in the latter days, I'll bring again the captivity of Elam, saith the Lord." So, Elam is actually located very close to where Babylon is. Unlike all the rest of them that are usually right around Israel, Elam is all the way over there on the Tigris River. And they're nearby. We see the same pattern for them as for everybody else. Their fall and their destruction comes and they don't know how to handle it. But he says at the very beginning something that's going to be helpful for us. Look at verse number 35. "I will break the bow of Elam, the chief of their might." They were known to have very good archery skills. But he says, God will break their bow. They thought that they would be safe because they were capable of handling the opposition that came their way. It's okay, because if we're attacked by Babylon, we have the skill set to ward them off. But he says, they're not going to be successful. And when you first grow up, you're scared of adulthood because you don't know how to do anything, and you know it. You don't know how to file your taxes. You don't know how to make a budget. You don't know how to fix stuff in your house or on your car. You don't know enough about electricity, whether or not the repairman's lying to you or not. You don't know how to protect your family if there's danger. Your wife asks you to build the thing, and you don't know how to build things. And so suddenly we're scared to death of adulthood because we don't know how to do things. But then as we get older, we learn how to do things. We know how to fix stuff, and we know how to take care of our stuff at our house, and we know enough about the repair that we know if the repairman's giving us is overestimating his skill or how much it's going to cost. And so we use that mindset and we apply it to every area of our life and we think of all the alternative ways that things might go wrong, and it's okay because I will be able to take care of it. If the electric grid collapses, it's okay. I have the skills to provide for my family. If we're overwhelmed by a massive list of things to take care of ourselves, it's okay. We can always just learn a few more, and that's fine. Go ahead. Do the survival skills and learn to hunt and learn the repairs, and that's okay, but it can get very overwhelming when you realize that in order to truly take care of you, you have to be capable of doing everything. And we're not. We're not capable of doing everything. And for Elam, they said, it's okay when life's opposition comes my way, I'll be able to handle it. And the chapter tells us they didn't. They were not capable enough. Their bow was not strong enough. And every one of us has a bow where we think, it's okay, I have this tool in my bag that will give me enough skills to handle what comes my way. And sometimes it isn't enough. And it'll never be enough. We are not capable of handling all of life's problems. All we do is we learn some things, but we often learn how many other things we don't know how to do as things go along the way. But that's okay. Because the Bible never tells us that we're supposed to have it all figured out. It never says that we are responsible to ultimately be the one who cares for ourselves. Because God is our refuge and our fortress. That's what he tells us to do. He tells you to take the overwhelmingness of life and recognize that we are not capable. And that's all right. Because at the end of the day, other than that, what we're doing is we're trusting us. And we are not a great place to put our own trust. Now let's go back to Damascus really quickly as we conclude. When we trust things other than God, and we truly trust them, we think that it'll save us. And when it doesn't, we're surprised. Look at verse 23. Go back to Damascus. Damascus was the capital of Syria, which doesn't have power at this point, but it did in recent years. Concerning Damascus, Hamath is confounded and Arpad, but they have heard evil tidings. They are faint-hearted. There is sorrow on the sea. It cannot be quiet. Damascus is waxed feeble and turneth herself to flee. Fear hath seized on her. Anguish and sorrows have taken her as a woman in travail. How is the city of praise not left, the city of my joy? Therefore her young men shall fall in her streets, and all the men of war shall be cut off in that day, saith the Lord of hosts. I'll kindle a fire in the wall of Damascus, and it shall consume the palaces of Ben-Hadad, which was a common name for a Syrian king. This section almost has no content in it at all. It says the same thing. They fell. It doesn't give an indictment. It doesn't say what they trusted in. Who knows what Damascus trusted in? Their skill, their entitlement, their safety nets? Certainly not their luck. But what did they trust? It doesn't say. But what it does say, verse 25, is they were surprised. How is the city of praise not left? The city of my joy. Whatever it was they trusted and whatever it was they expected, they stood back one day and went, what happened? How is this life I have built gone? Where did it go? What happened? And that's what a lot of people do in their life. They've trusted something other than the Lord, and then it wasn't enough, and they're surprised because everyone told them it would be fine. And then it wasn't, and they go, wait, what happened? And this chapter also reminds us where our trust should truly be, because even in this chapter, of all chapters, there is still a thread of mercy through it. Remember at the very end of last chapter with Moab, he says, it's okay because then I will turn again their captivity. God says, I will have hope on the other side of this. Not you. You're not going to turn this around. One day in my mercy, I will turn this around for you. He says that twice in this chapter. Look at verse number 6. After talking to Ammon, he says, afterward, I will bring again the captivity of the children of Ammon, saith the Lord. We don't have time to get into it, but Moab was one of the children of Lot from his own daughters. After all that foolishness in his life, God kept them alive. Ammon was the other brother. And yet, in the middle of all that, God was willing to spare them. And that's how the chapter ends, too. The very last verse in the chapter says the same thing to Elam. It will come to pass in the latter days, I will bring again the captivity of Elam. But this is also one important moment I want you to see. Well, this is the last verse we'll read and we'll be done. Look at verse 11. In the middle of his message to Edom, God says, you know what? You can't take care of you. And you can't take care of your family. But I can. Look at verse 11. Leave thy fatherless children. I will preserve them alive. And let thy widows trust in me. He reminds them, you got all these plans to take care of all the people around you, and you can't. He says, but I will. The Bible tells us that in the book of Psalms, that God is a father of the fatherless and a judge of the widows. God is in his holy habitation. God setteth the solitary in families, and he bringeth out those which are bound with chains. But the rebellious will dwell in a dry land. He says, at the end of the day, it's not going to be hard for God to take care of us. And for God to take care of our families. But it's whether or not we trust in him, whether we're going to get to experience any of that. It's not wrong to have survival skills or to have savings or to live in the country that gives you rights or to live in the peaceful village of Dover. But none of those things is our salvation. So when we are the squirrel scared by the car coming down on the road, we have to ask ourselves the question, where do we run? Because if it's not to the Lord, it will not be enough. And then we're going to be surprised, but we shouldn't have been, because he told us not to be. Where do you put your trust?